I'm uncertain about everything else in this thing, except that I exist and he exists. I'm pretty sure you exist too.
Do you want to start? I'm going to talk to Dorothy for a minute.
Sure, well, we'll just talk a little bit about this. Okay. Wait till we make this. We're having fun.
Okay.
Bill, when the car you came over here and said over the radio or the television that you didn't believe in God, that everybody was so shocked because it was the first time they heard anyone on television say that he did not believe in the God. Nicole, what was the name of that person that came?
What? Nicoyan or something?
Nicoyan, that's what I saw. How does a man get that way? I mean, has he been conditioned from birth that there
could
was
be.
A God?
This could be, or he could have a very unfortunate experience.
He's the one that killed.
Well, gee, Helene, if you'd ask me, age 16, did I believe in God, I would say I don't know. That would have been the only factual answer I could have given you. If you'd ask me at age 11, do I believe in God, I would have said yes, but it would have been, I didn't believe in God, I believed in a big man with a white beard. A very anthropomorphic God. It's a typical child's God. It's a good one for a child to have, too.
It'll have to be further up.
That's wonderful.
Well, I've gone from, shall we say, this mystic feeling of nothingness to I became philosophic and in college. I took this college course. Up until that time, I had God with the long beard watching little me down there.
Yes.
And suddenly I decided I was paddling my own canoe. There was nothing, absolutely nothing watching me. I became, it was Spinoza that said, all is God. It just seemed there was nothing in that feeling. So I didn't progress much far from Buddhist feeling. From that time on until, I suppose 2 months ago, I really could have said, I don't know too. So that this is awfully late in my life, but I hope not too late.
Oh no, I don't think it's late.
I was 35 before I got the other experience.
Well, I was lucky. I had a whole lot of things happen. There was this debate in the barracks. And I remember I was in Washington. I didn't usually wear my brass buttons, but I had them on this day. So I guess I looked like a policeman. And some joker came and asked me, where's such and such a church? And I asked him, I told him. And I don't know what prompted me to say, where are you going? And he looked at me with utter disgust. He says, why do you see Calvin Coolidge? Why do you think I'm going? And this turned the lights on. I thought, I'd always thought the people who went to church were religious, and because I didn't go to church, I just wasn't. And this informed me that there were many motives for going to church. This was a very shocking discovery, and a very good one to make, too. And then there were a whole succession of things that happened in about a 60-day period, which imparted momentum to my curiosity. Very ordinary things, but they added up. And at the end of that period, I discovered I was like a hound dog trying to pick up a scent. I mean, this was a very absorbing thing. Anytime I had, I thought. And I can't tell you when I found it. You see, I'm not the conversion type. Nothing wonderful happens to me. It's all done. It's not done like the writing of the American Constitution. That's conversion. I built mine up like the British got their Constitution. It took so damn many days and nights that I wasn't conscious. All I could do was look back at some point and say, gee, this is different now. And I can't tell you when it happened. I discovered this when I was writing a letter. When I started the letter, I was asking questions, and when I finished the letter, I knew. But I didn't make the discovery writing the letter. I merely discovered that this had happened, because that doesn't happen that way. And I've known ever since, for sure, for absolute sure. That's the only thing I'm sure about. I know he is. Are we on the air?
Yeah.
Should we go adventuring in the firehouse?
Yeah.
We just completed the construction of the firehouse yesterday. We spent most of yesterday on the third floor. In the last half hour of yesterday, we considered how the 1,600-mile second floor and the 2-inch first floor got constructed. I like to compare those 2 inches with the 1,600 miles, because most of this book is about the 2 inches, and that seems frightfully big. If you will look at page 1162, we can further illuminate page 5 of the foreword. In the foreword, they say that reality is comprehended by finite beings as partial, relative, and shadowy. The maximum deity reality, fully comprehensible by evolutionary finite creatures, is embraced within the supreme being. So, pretty much what we call real is not what the authors of these papers would call real. Here on page 1162, they take inventory of reality. They start out with incomplete finites. That's us. This is the present status of the ascending creatures of the grand universe, the present status of your rancher mortals. This level embraces creature existence from the planetary human up to, but not including, destiny attainers. It pertains to universes from early physical beginnings up to, but not including, settlement in light and life. This level constitutes the present periphery of creative activity in time and space. It appears to be moving outward from paradise, for the closing of the present universe age, which will witness the grand universe attainment of light and life, will also and surely witness the appearance of some new order of developmental growth in the first outer space level. That's a pretty good description in one paragraph, I think, of rather much of what's going on in the seven super universes. A finaliter is an incomplete finite. He's not a destiny attainer. In contrast to a spirit-fused or a sun-fused mortal, who is a complete finite, they've attained destiny. So also is a mighty messenger attained destiny. And of course, destiny attainment pertains to the present universe age. The fact that a mighty messenger is a non-growing being doesn't mean that he is eternally non-growing. He just doesn't grow now. And this now has to do with the present universe age, which we've estimated is maybe half over, and it's, well, what was it, 40,000 trillions of years.
While we are on the subject of attainment, may we at this time kill Bud and send him on his way and see what happens?
Yes. It's a good place to consider this. First we view the remains. Some will view these remains in sorrow, and some with glee, but that's life. And Bud will sleep a varying length of time. Bud may make it in 3 days if he's got a personal guardian. Or he might make it as a part of some special group. Maybe the Blue Book group, you know. There was a special deal when Adam died. The survivors of Eden all went over together in a group. They let Eve sleep for 17 years until Adam died, then they brought them over together, which was nice. She didn't have any time of waiting. Or it might be a millennial thing. Every 1,000 years, they tap the barrel and draw off a few pints. Or it might be dispensational. They empty the whole barrel in and start over clean. At any rate, be it 3 days or some longer time interval, Bud wakes up on this marble slab on the first mansion world. He wakes up because they've drawn a GI body suitable for Bud, not too dissimilar to the one he's got, and they've reassembled him. His group or personal seraphim has deposited his soul. The adjusters come back. The life carrier has vitalized that body. There would have to be a life carrier there. They put in a mind circuit, and then the personality simply appears. That's all. No one knows how it gets there. And when this personality seizes that mind circuit, that is the return of consciousness. Some archangel or deputy of an archangel will take the fingerprints of that personality so that they know it's Bud. They can prove it. Everybody's sure it is. The adjuster would be evidence of that. But for the official record, you know. So, he cuts loose. On the first mansion world, the first thing he gets is 10 days vacation. And their days are three times as long as ours, so that's a month off. And that's for casual orientation. And then they'll put him through some tests. They'll check him out. And let's say that he really doesn't have any job to do on the first mansion world. So they'll graduate. They'll lay him down and transport him to the second mansion world. And they go through this whole business all over again. Because the change from mansion world is so radical that they can't rekey these bodies. You get seven new bodies, one for each mansion world. We'll say that Bud doesn't quite make it on the second mansion world, so here he has to go to work, go to school. He goes to school by doing certain jobs. And to do these jobs, he's got to master certain lessons. Then he's got to socialize. It's a school of thinking, feeling, and doing. And when he passes his exams, this is when he teaches the course he's learned. And when he can do this, then he can go on. He gets his grade in that course. Most of the work which they do on these early mansion worlds has to do with de-animalizing us. It's negative. It's trying to bring us up to where people should really get if they were really on the ball. It's getting us up to the cultural level, the spiritual cultural level, which Jesus attained when he was, what, 32 years of age? Or 33, was he? 32, I believe. He did that in 32 years. Enoch did it. Probably in much longer time. Elijah did it. These are people that made it without death.
You're speaking of the Bob-tester.
Yes. They fused here in this lifetime. Jesus, if Jesus had been an ordinary man, he'd have left this world when he was 32. He'd have fused with his thought adjuster. Which is one reason they had to detach his adjuster. They couldn't leave it in there.
Where did you say that's done on the average, Bill?
On the fifth mansion world is about where it will take place. Somewhere along about the fourth mansion world, it's less of a deficiency ministry and more of a real teaching business. It's less negative, making up for what we didn't do, and more positive. Let's say Bud is typical, and on the fifth mansion world, he fuses with his thought adjuster. And there's a scene described there which is analogous to the scene in the Jordan at the baptism of Jesus. An archangel will appear, someone will appear, I don't think it's an archangel. And he will speak to Bud in the presence of his associates, saying, "This is a beloved son in whom I am well pleased." And fusion takes place. And at that time, Bud is excused from all duties and assignments. I imagine this is this experience leaves one a bit shook up, because all of a sudden an iron curtain goes down and there's a lot more room inside. There's a whole annex there that you suspected was there. You could hear thumpings on the other side of the wall and occasionally hear them playing the stereo, you know? And all of a sudden now you break through and you get to know your neighbor. And you go away and sit down and figure out who you are. It's at this time you get a name. The names we use now, they don't count. Santa Ann and Santa N were the names which the first two human beings had here on Earth. It was at the time of fusion that they were christened Andon and Fanta. And these names have significance. The name Andon means the first father-like human being to exhibit perfection hunger. And Fanta means the first son-like human being to exhibit perfection hunger. So I don't know what they'll call Bud. I hope there aren't too many syllables in it, because Bud is easier to say. At any rate, after this fusion experience, when Bud gets acquainted with his partner, and they really draw up the articles of partnership, this has all been tentative, you know. The adjuster's been on consignment, but now the sale is closed. When fusion takes place, you bought something. Then you go back to work, and it's simply more of the same, except this milestone has been passed. Bud knows that there's nothing but time separating him from God. And he'll get to Jerusalem and take up citizenship. And for a while, he won't grow so fast. This is sitting down kind of between rounds. I fancy that we're citizens on Jerusalem for quite a long while. And there, we enjoy things as adults. We're not just pupils now. We're citizens. We're performing a job. We're grown up. This is the second adult experience we have, the first one being here. This is a time when universe horizons stand still, when the goal has been attained. And we taste all of the sweetness of success. We've scored. This is home plate. I don't know how long we stay there, but long enough, I think, to get full satisfaction in success. And then one day, our psychology does a flip. We get itchy feet. All of a sudden, these horizons, instead of being comfortingly stationary, begin to look small. We begin to wonder what's on the other side of the mountains. And this is probably the indication that it's time for us to move on to the constellation level. Of course, we've learned a lot on Jerusalem. The Melchizedeks have worked us over. We've gotten acquainted with the really permanent citizens of Jerusalem, the Adams. And it's been an altogether delightful experience. We're still pretty material, because even though we're eighth stage Maranchans, when we go to the library, we exhibit a preference for the material records, not the Marantia records, much less spiritual records.
Do you think there is a consciousness of this ascendancy?
Sure, we know exactly where we are and what we're doing. We're just as conscious of growth up there as we're conscious of growth down here, even more so, much more so. I think we have a social experience that's very refreshing, in contrast to the rather narrow social experience which we have here on Earth. I think we really mix and mingle with our fellow ascenders, and gee, there's folks, you know, from 618 other worlds pouring in here.
You're still speaking of Jerusalem?
Yes.
I thought the socializing came on one of the mansion worlds before we got there.
I think it's all the way up the line.
Oh, I see.
We just haven't got around to talking about it until now. There are people from 618 other worlds moving on up to Jerusalem. Just think, 618 planetary histories we get acquainted with, heroes and heroines that we know about. And there's chances to go visiting these worlds if we could ever hitchhike, because we probably won't actually have business there. You can't command transportation unless you've got a commission. If you're going to be a tourist, you've got to find transportation. As Bud put it, you're on standby. You can't get a confirmed reservation, but Seraphim are coming and going all the time, and they're obliging folks, and I dare say we'll get to see a fair percentage of these inhabited worlds.
Do you still have that relative free will?
Sure you do.
Of
course you have. Of course. There are worlds that must be fascinating. We can go see this neighboring planet that we read about. We could go see Panopsia, where they really had a Joan of Arc. Do you know the story of Panopsia? Panopsia is a sister world of ours. was planetary prince joined Lucifer. And it's probably a world with a much more advanced culture than ours. It's probably a world where most of the world knew about the planetary prince. And there was a woman on Panatra by the name of Eleonora who defied the planetary prince. And she swung the whole bloody human race behind her.
A mortal woman,
yes. So that the humans of Panoptia disavowed their rebellious planetary prince. And the Panoptians are unique in our local system. Technically, it's a rebel world, but the rebellion totally failed on Panoptia.
Was it isolated?
Yeah, had to be isolated.
Did it take the Nick Myers along with it?
I don't know.
It was in our local system.
Yes. At any rate, the Panoptians have a unique function in going through the system headquarters. They act as the custodians of the interned rebels. Yeah, there's Joan of Arc for sure.
Gee, that's fascinating.
That story's just barely mentioned in connection with the Lucifer Rebellion. Her name was Eleonora. And the name of the world is Panoptia. It's one of the 37 isolated worlds.
These mutineers killed their captain. Took over.
This is a good adventure story for your high school group.
Yes.
It's a beautiful story.
I think we'll see most of these worlds. We'll go as student visitors. And we'll be invisible to the people. We won't be able to interfere with anything. We'll need
spaceships? Flying saucers?
No, we'll go by seraphic transport.
Bill, what is the highest attainment our hero can reach?
Who?
But
we haven't got him started yet. He can be, as far as we know, and I don't think we begin to know all the things. I think they've just suggested, they've given us samplings. According to the Blue Book, he can be any one of four things. Any one of five things. If he couldn't fuse with his adjuster, and this is an extraordinarily rare thing, way below 0.01%, he would be a sun-fused mortal. And then he would become a permanent citizen of the super universe. Considering how many worlds there are and how few sun-fused mortals there are, this is something that happens with... This is an amazing thing. This doesn't happen once in a million years in a local universe, but it does happen now and then. It is a possibility. Or the surest thing he's going to be is a finaliter. He's an adjuster-fused ascender. He goes into the core of the finality. If on his way up, he should encounter rebellion and be loyal, or if he should prevent it, then his tour of duty as a finaliter would be temporary. He would be withdrawn, would be embraced by the Trinity, and would then be commissioned as a mighty messenger. Or let's say he's got an extraordinary administrative gift. He's a natural-born executive. The same thing would happen, only then he would become one high in authority. He'd be an officer of the government of the Ancients of Days in some super universe. Or let's say that he is a rarer bird. There are 100 times as many mighty messengers as there are this last category. There are 10 times as many executives as fall in this last category. This last category is a person who has an unusual grasp of the spiritual intent of the deities. And when their trinity embraced, they become those without name and number.
Is there a stabilization of categories?
No, this is just that these are the possible destinies.
I get confused. It's like reading a Tolstoy novel. You don't quite, yes. I have my characters in order. But say the Lenanindex, the Melchizedex, do they become something other than that? Is this their highest attainment, or do they go on?
They're comparatively stationary. They're created as mm-hmm. such, and ordinarily remain about as such. There are, again, rare exceptions. The Melchizedek, who lived here on this world probably is going on to the core of the finality. And there are probably six others like him in the local universe. There are always exceptions to the general rule, but this would be the general rule. Generally, the Melchizedek's keep serving as Melchizedek's.
Bill, we don't know, they say nothing about the destiny of these descending sons or stationary sons in the next universe age. It could be altogether different.
Oh, yes. For example, when Bud goes on to the constellation, he'll live with the Univitatia. And since the beginning of the super universes, the Univitatia have always lived on the constellations. They're permanent citizens. As far as we know, they will forever live there. But the papers speculate that possibly Univitatia may move into Havona in the next universe age. The life carrier, who writes those interesting introductory papers in part one, points out that they have three phases of function. Normally, they're in the mid-phase, which would be analogous to Marantia, but isn't. They can step down into a physical phase, which they have to work in if they're going to manipulate stuff to build chromosomes. When he took renunciation vows and accepted a detached assignment to remain here on Earth as an observer, he and one of his buddies, then he moved into a semi-spirit phase. He said, we all look forward to someday attaining a fourth level of existence, completely spiritual. But no one has yet shown us how to do this. So there is change, but not this radical change such as takes place in a human being who starts out an animal and ends up a finality.
Then the higher the ascendancy, the slower the change.
Yes, yes.
Now suppose that he leaves progeny, that he loves dearly,
yes.
He dies. What contact, or is there a contact as he ascends?
Sure, if he wants it. Let's say that Bud makes it on the third day. Let's just say we have Bud Jr. We'll keep it simple. We'll have one progeny. And these two were pretty close. And Bud's on the fifth mansion world. And Bud Jr. doesn't make the third circle. He gets killed accidentally. And he has to wait a long time. So that Bud is up on the fifth mansion world, or sixth, by the time this guy lands. Bud's been over there for 28,000 years, getting up this far. And he hears about this. Doesn't hear about it right away. They don't single Bud out and say, your son made it. But in due course, it's about 800 years after Bud Jr. lands on the first mansion world that Bud casually finds this out. He reads something, it's a squib in the paper, you know? So, he's next. free period, he goes down to the second mansion world where Bud Jr. is. And it's quite a reunion. So they see each other, and this guy, by the time Bud's on Jerusalem, Bud Jr. is on the third mansion world. There's a terrific gap there. But this time they cooked up a deal. And Bud goes into the assignment office on Jerusalem, and he says, now look, normally I know what you do, but here's a job that's waiting over here, and I could do this job. This job's going to take quite a long while. I'd like to drop out of the group I'm with and wait for my son. In the meantime, I'll do this job for you. This is a quid pro quo.
What floor is he waiting on?
On Jerusalem.
Well,
first floor.
The system capital.
First floor of the fire.
Yes,
way on the first floor. All of this story is on the first floor of the firehouse.
My, in the little 2 inches.
Yes, quite.
No, thank you.
Well, we're all short.
We are now, Betty, we've moved up 1 micron above the floor. 1 micron, that's a millionth part of a millimeter. And a millimeter is...
What's
that
to the mile?
A micron, Helene, is it a millionth part of a millimeter?
Uh-huh.
And a millimeter, there are 1,000 of them in something less than an inch. No, wait a minute. No, there's 1,000. No, wait a minute, I'm all fouled up here. A centimeter is a little less than an inch, and there are 10 millimeters in a centimeter. This is about, it's about a millionth part of a 64th of an inch.
Well, the inches are all I'm not actually.
It's something that's so small a part of an inch that you couldn't measure. That's how far we come up with it.
Can I offer something for a second? Considering the first floor is a typical California firehouse versus slab floor, and you put a asphalt tile cover over one.
We're not even the emulsion then.
And you just step from the concrete onto the asphalt tile.
Mm-hmm.
A 16th of an inch.
This two inches seems small only in comparison to the next floor. Actually, it's tremendously big. So they take Bud up on this proposition. He could do a good job. He's not the only person who could do it, but he could do a good job. And so he accepts a special assignment that's going to take him around 20,000 years to complete. And when this job is over, Bud Jr.'s made it to Jerusalem. So they've caught up with each other. This you can do. This is not a mechanical universe. Your wishes are respected within reason. They won't turn the thing upside down for you, but they'll make any reasonable adjustment.
Bill,
yes.
Mike mentioned that she, in that first 10-day, which is a month, period, when you first land, you could look up people who've not gone before, your parents.
Oh, yeah.
Still on Jerusalem, though.
No, yeah.
We're
on Jerusalem.
Oh,
anywhere in the system, though. Isn't that right, Bill?
Yeah.
Bill,
you can look him up. You
could get Bill, but it's John. His son is still on Earth, on
yes.
Urantia.
Yeah.
Can he make
no.
the hair go up on the back of his
no.
boy's neck? And the boy's
because
neck the
there's only one place you can't come. Of all the 619 worlds, this one is forbidden. You cannot come back here. You cannot communicate with here. The only information you can get from here is as anybody comes up from here, a seraphim who's been on duty. You can go down and get the latest poop, you know, from your ranch.
Or you can listen to the broadcast.
If it's mentioned.
Yeah.
Or you can talk to people who are trickling through. There's a continuous stream of information coming up from this world as people ascend. But you could never come back to this world in the same mortal epoch that you died. You could come back in a future mortal epoch if you had business here.
What would that business be?
Take John the Baptist. He was at one time resident governor general of this world. So he could come back, because technically he's as of the preceding dispensation.
And so could Moses.
Moses came back,
or Elijah,
yes.
Or Enoch.
Adam came back as resident governor general. Yeah. Eve came back as resident governor general.
You've got a woman in
the back. Yes.
I think that's a good idea that you can't communicate or know, because, for example, let's take some guy that is married to a woman he loves very much, and they have quite a few material things, and he's able to look down here and see her pouring some other guy a cup of coffee out of his coffee pot.
Or worse still, investing in this other guy's phony oil stock. But these aren't hard
earned
money.
That makes you feel pretty bad, so you're better off not doing it.
That's right.
Are any of the physical ills picked up by this new Mirage form?
I don't think so.
We don't go on as we were
I don't
physically
think you,
only.
I don't think you can catch cold on the first mansion worlds, but I think you could break a leg. You could have a physical accident.
But if you had a leg
this body
minus a leg here,
you'd
have
up
with those minus legs.
No, why would they?
Or any physical ills of any type? Are you subject to all those things?
No. There are no bacteria. There are no parasitic bacteria up there. These are architectural worlds. These are not worlds.
The first mansion worlds.
I'm talking about all of the Mirantia worlds.
Mm-hmm.
You see, these worlds have life on them. And this life never evolved. It was not worked out by a competitive process. This life was put there, this life, the plant life, the animal life, the lower and higher animal orders. The Sparnegi are the highest of the animal orders. It's all there. There is an adaptation. There is a cooperativeness that's built in. It is not competitive. There are no carnivorous animals up there.
We don't eat up there.
We eat. We eat, breathe, and drink. And the only difference is there's no residual ash left over from our eating.
Thank God.
We eat, but there are no bathrooms on the at least if we have bathrooms for bathing purposes, there'll be one other familiar object that will be missing from the bathroom because it's superfluous. It's unneeded. I always remember old Phil Copenhaver, who used to say that this was his principal incentive for trying to survive, because he'd been harassed with constipation all his life. And he so much wanted a body, just the problem couldn't come up.
And if we eat and drink?
We eat Marantia food. On these worlds, Betty, they're physical and Marantia.
This is not a world of procreation.
No. We are still male and female. We have all of the primary and secondary sex differences, but we're not procreating beings. Which, of course, means that we can socialize in a lot of ways that are a little on the taboo side down here.
Now, if one still has the urge to procreate, that would be one hell of a place to live, couldn't it?
Yes, that's right. That's right.
Well, now...
We won't have that chemistry.
Bill, explain that sentence, the last statement before that, about
right.
The differentials are the same physically?
I don't know. The essential difference is internal. It's
right.
In outlook and in reaction. And these papers instruct me that even in the core of the finality, men and women will continue to intrigue each other because they won't react the same. There is a difference. And even there we may, some Frenchman who's in the finality core will probably say, vive la difference.
But not on a, they won't intrigue each other on a physical level. There's a lot of people.
How could
that are,
they be physical?
That's right. So on the Marantia level, where you are partially physical, partially,
mm-hmm.
You're Marantia.
That's right.
But you're still discernible. You have a form.
Yes.
Women will have a form.
Yes.
You will know. Will you know a woman by sight?
I'm sure you will.
Then
at least
she,
in the earlier stages.
All right. Then she will have to be physically so constituted to look like a woman.
I would think there'd be a difference. What difference, I don't know.
Well, it doesn't seem logical to me that you evolved so
maybe they
all these other areas that you wouldn't physically too, and that some
maybe
of these physically else.
Maybe they require women to wear pink tunics and men wear blue tunics.
Well,
you remember that? Maybe they require that women wear pink tunics and boys wear blue tunics. You know the story of the fence? That they held a little boy up so he could look over? And he said, they said, what's on the other side? He said, people. Well, they said, are they men or women? He said, I can't tell. They haven't got any clothes on. The social life in the Marantia world will be, I think, very refreshing. Example, let's say that I'm intrigued very much with Bud. And I say, let's go fishing for a weekend. We'll do some fishing, a lot of talking. Perfectly acceptable. Let's say I'm very intrigued with Betty, and I am. I can't say to her here on Earth, let's go fishing for a weekend, and we'll get a lot of yak out. It would be a scandal. You follow me? This is possible in the Marantia life. This is not probably desirable here in this life. And then again, we have available other people. It'd be fun to spend a weekend with a seraphim. These are very intriguing personalities. Or a cherubim, or a Marantia companion, or somebody from some other world. And we listen to him tell us all about how his planet got to be the way it was. This is a very, very interesting thing. These worlds, I think the atmosphere is symbolic of these worlds. There are three gases. There's a physical atmosphere because there are physical beings there, like the atoms who breathe as we breathe. like the Spornagia, who breathe as we breathe. And the third gas supports Marantia respiration. There are two forms of vegetation on these worlds. There is the familiar green vegetation, which we see right here with chlorophyll. And there is a violet-hued vegetation, which is Marantia in nature.
Is this where there are 200 elements?
Mm-hmm. There are 100 physical elements and 100 Marantia elements on these worlds.
And the heat and vent system there is really fantastic.
It doesn't rain, but they have a low dew point, a high dew point, rather, in a three-gas atmosphere. Every night dew falls and refreshes the vegetation.
Don't the imperfections creep in any place on this physical level in the nature, too? Any place that we have here? They must.
You mean up there?
I'm thinking, well, just take the bugs and the weeds.
No, because they don't get started. This is non-evolutionary life, Julie.
Oh, I see.
This life was designed and planted. It was constructed just like the world. A Spornagia did not evolve from a lower form. A Spornagia has always been a Spornagia.
Well, this begins to sound like our old idea of heaven.
Yes. When we describe Jerusalem, we're describing something which is considerably better than the average human being's idea of heaven, and we're just one asphalt tile thickness up.
When John in his book of Revelation saw this,
yes,
he called it heaven.
Sure he does. And I think the descriptions which they give us of Jerusalem are pretty factual, because Jerusalem is the most physical of all of the places we'll go to.
Then is there death there?
No. Well, yes, there is at the animal level. The animals are not immortal.
But they can reincarnate.
But all physical life is perfect there.
Let's not say perfect, but let's say in exquisite balance with all other physical life.
I mean, these physical forms we all pick up, everything else, all of this is perfect there.
Not perfect, Julia. Not perfect. Not perfect, but harmonious.
Well,
it's less than perfect. I'm talking
about
the physical setup. If you can have an accident and break a leg, this is not perfect. But I'm sure that they do an awfully good job of setting your life.
Well, let's just get to the birth stage. Now here, all birds.
You've got little.
The body may be imperfect.
Yes.
But there it is.
There it's good.
Take the initial stage.
There our bodies are on the order of the body that Machiavelli and Melchizedek wore. On the order of the bodies designed for the
corporeal
staff of the planetary prince. Now those bodies were not perfect, but they were tremendously efficient.
I looked for this, but I never could find that the physical Marantia body you pick up.
It isn't perfect. It's just excellent. It's excellent.
It wouldn't be subject to all the errors we have.
No, and I think this, Julia, if an imperfection should creep in, it would be corrected. Just as much as say, General Motors turns out a car that's got imperfections, and they fix them, then it runs.
This is sure an important point for all the people who are going to read this book who are sick, born imperfect.
Well, if they're going to equalize you, they got to start you off at least with a decent body.
With a chance.
Yeah.
One thing, the millions that are born imperfect here.
Yes.
Well, that's a.
They'll have normal bodies up there, and they'll be good ones.
Would you explain about the Spornagia, how they can get a new body when they wear it out?
Well, here's what happens. These Spornagia live for an awfully long time. I think it's about 40,000 years.
This is on Jerusalem.
Right. And these Spornagia are purely physical beings. They have five adjutants. They are exquisitely beautiful and highly intelligent. In fact, these Spornagia are so intelligent, they speak. They speak the language. They direct the lower mammalian orders in the physical care of the planet. They are glorified animals. A Spornog's body can wear out, even though it's well constructed. And when an old Spornagia is going to die, the life carriers build another body for him. And this Spornagia has a five-adjutant mind, but this five-adjutant mind totals, d-
to a sixth level. This is not the adjutant of worship, but this is a totality which constitutes the identity of the Sparnagia, not a personality. And they can pick this up and put it in the new body. And this is reincarnation, and this is the only form of reincarnation in existence.
I showed this to Jack Weiss. You know, he used to be very heavy on reincarnation. Yeah. And he said that, I'm so surprised the book doesn't have reincarnation. I said, but it does. So I turned to that, and we read it. And as you see, there's something for everyone in this book. And he just smiled and was so happy.
Yeah.
Even though it wasn't going to be him, he was still happy.
These Sparnagia are technically vulnerable to death, but practically, with the aid of the life carriers, they don't die. And the book speculates, they wonder if they're always going to remain animals, or will they change in the next universe age? You see, if the Father gave them personality, they'd become moral beings. The Sparnagia has certain powers of choice, just like Tiglath has, but such choice is operative on a sub-moral level. They attend in worship. They don't know what worship is about, but they like us. And when we go, they go for the same reason Tiglath might accompany Bud to church. This world in which we live has fluctuations in light. About three quarters of the day, the light is about the intensity of the sun at 10 o'clock in the morning. And the remaining part of the day, the light diminishes until it's about as dark as it is when there's a full moon. This world does not have sunlight. This world is a self-lighting world. They funnel energy currents up into the atmosphere, and the atmosphere has something similar to our ionosphere, which reflects this light back down on the planet like an even sifting light. And that's how they can regulate it, so that mostly it's light and the night isn't as long. There are no mountain ranges on any of these worlds, because mountain ranges are formed by geologic cataclysms. And these worlds had no cataclysms. They have no storms, no tornadoes, no hurricanes, no rain, just dew. There are no oceans, but there are streams, there are lakes. And while there are no mountains, there are highlands that were designed that way. The topography is exciting. It's interesting.
Are there fish there, Bill, so we can go fishing?
I don't know.
Maracha fish?
I don't know. I'm sure we're not carnivorous.
No, but I mean, if we're going to sit there and talk, I'd want to get a nibble once in a while. Maybe they'll get something there that will nibble to look like a fish.
Could be. If not, you will design a mechanical fish that can swim. There is an economy up there. They have factories which manufacture. But they don't look like our factories because there are no smoking chimneys. They have airplanes up there, I'm sure, because the Adamites and physical beings, and we will be virtually physical beings, we can't travel around on the energy circuits. We still require a mechanical device to get around in. I'm sure they have airports up there. Yes.
They wouldn't have Sparnagia birds, wouldn't they, that we could fly?
Pandors? I don't know, maybe. They had passenger birds here on this world in the days of Adam. They called them Pandors. They were the apex of avian evolution. They were the most intelligent of all birds, and they could speak a good deal of the language like a parrot does. They understood what they were saying. And they could transport a human being. They were still in existence in the days of Eden.
Isn't this where the flying horse came from, Bill?
I suppose, yeah.
I think it is. I was reading about that, you know, remember in the, what they call a flying horse, Julia?
Pegasus.
I'm positive that's where they got it because there's legends about it.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought we had something similar in our very earliest evolution.
Yeah,
The Fandors, the flying bird. They give us the name.
Do they have money?
I think they must.
We have to learn to make
that. I think they must. There must be some indication. There must be some indication that you're entitled to service. I think later on there is no money. But in the earlier mansion worlds, I've pondered this and pondered this. You see, we're not yet altruistic. We're not yet boiling over with this desire to serve. I think we require penalties. I think we need to go broke if we haven't done our homework. You know what I mean?
We need to learn the training of handling finance accurately.
Mostly, I think we still need the stimulus of a medium of exchange. You see, the service motif doesn't really take hold until about the fifth mansion world. And they're not going to abandon the profit and loss motive until a better one is taken over. They're not going to throw away one that works for one that's idealistic and won't work.
Well, if we're going to have food, are we going to have clothing?
Yeah, I suppose.
We'll need money.
I'll feel better dressed up there.
We'll need something
yes?
We use
mm-hmm.
in exchange.
Mm-hmm. There's a physical economy up there, as well as a Maranchi economy and a spirit economy. Jerusalem will be full of people that we won't see. It will be full of people that we will see. And I think there is a threshold of our advancing sensory mechanism where there will be situations in which we may see someone or we may not see someone. Let us say, are we, morantially speaking, upwind or downwind from them? You follow me?
Mm-hmm.
I think we will encounter transitional perception as our sensory mechanism expands. Because while we never lose our old perceptive techniques, we are adding new ones all the time. And that's why they can't tell us much about the celestial artisans. They work in ways that simply don't register on us. It's just as hard to tell us about what they do as it is to describe the color red to one who was born colorblind.
But Bill, they're very kind to us because they'll show us the finaliters, make it visible to us.
Mm-hmm.
This is the preview of the coming of truth.
Right. We can see things that we can't see in the same sense that a fluoroscope will reveal to us many things which we couldn't otherwise see. The X-ray technique, I think, is a good method. Or this gizmo will trap waves which don't register on our sensory mechanism.
Then there is a culture and a new appreciation of culture.
Right. As we move up the line, we have something to say about what we do. There are required courses and there are electives. There is more than one route that we can take. And they will not let us do anything which is really harmful to us or anyone else. But there's a great big gray area there, which is optional. And they respect our choice. They may counsel us to say, it would be better if you did this, but I want to do this. Well, now they would give us a good sell. And if they couldn't sell us, they'd say, all right, Betty, do that, try it. When you're through, you probably would realize it would have been better if you'd gone the other way. But you will have the satisfaction of having your own way and exploring it. I think within reason, they'll let us make something of fools of ourselves. Let's say that Bud arrives there, and the first time he gets on Jerusalem, he has a burning desire to be a musician. And he will talk to, let's see who he's going to talk to. We know about them in here.
Not the celestial musicians.
Just a minute.
The harmony workers. I've tried the piano and failed, but I might as well start on something else. I do pretty good with a comb.
That's mine.
Bud will talk to the mine planners. They're the vocational guidance experts up there. And they not only have to do with guiding us, but they group us for maximum of stimulus. In other words, they will build up a group which is very effective, because the group will spark each other. They assemble social groups for the value of the association. In other words, let's put it in terms of baseball. They won't put too many star pitchers on one team. They won't put they'll put just one good first baseman there. They'll pick one whale of a shortstop, one tremendously good catcher. In other words, they're assembling a team. They are assembling complementary aptitudes. They may put an Alpheus twin in there for the same reason that Jesus had an Alpheus, a couple of Alpheus twins. It is the task of the mine planners, these are seraphim, we're on page 553. It is the task of the mind planners to study the nature, experience, and status of the adjuster souls in transit through the mansion worlds, and to facilitate their grouping for assignment and advancement. But these mind planners do not scheme, manipulate, or otherwise take advantage of the ignorance or other limitations of mansion world students. They are wholly fair and eminently just. They respect your newborn Marantia will. They regard you as independent volitional beings. There's free will again. And they seek to encourage your speedy development and advancement. Here you are face to face with true friends and understanding counselors, angels who are really able to help you to see yourself as others see you, and to know yourself as angels know you. And here's an answer to a question you asked yesterday, Benny. Even on your rancher, these seraphim teach the everlasting truth. If your own mind does not serve you well, you can exchange it for the mind of Jesus of Nazareth, who always serves you well. See, they work down here too, because there are Marantia souls here. And these are the seraphim who are concerned with ministry to human beings who are in transition.
Explain that just a little more, Bill. Well, that brings up that last sentence you read just a
little. Well,
that's what we all want to do, right?
If you can learn, that's what we read in our excerpt on Christianity last night. If you can learn to live and love as Jesus taught his apostles to live and love and serve. You see, these angels are active down here. They're the first of these groups of the seraphic evangels. They will help you choose wisely among the optional routes to Edentia, Salvington, Uversa, and Havona. If there are a number of equally advisable routes, they will be put before you. You will be permitted to select the one that most appeals to you. These seraphim then make recommendations to the 24 advisors on Jerusalem concerning the course which would be most advantageous for each ascending soul. You're not given unrestricted choice as to your future course, but you may choose within the limits of that which the transition ministers and their superiors wisely determine to be the most suitable for your future spirit attainment. The spirit world is governed on the principle of respecting your free will choice, provided the course you may choose is not detrimental to you or injurious to your fellows.
Evangels help people down here?
Let me read. These seraphic evangels are dedicated to the proclamation of the gospel of eternal progression, the triumph of perfection attainment. On the mansion worlds, they proclaim the great law of the conservation and dominance of goodness. No act of good is ever wholly lost. It may be long thwarted, but never wholly annulled. And it is eternally potent in proportion to the divinity of its motivation. Even on your rancho, they counsel the human teachers of truth and righteousness to adhere to the preaching of the goodness of God, which leads to repentance, to proclaim the love of God, which casts out all fear. Even so have these truths been declared on your world. The gods are my caretakers. I shall not stray. Side by side, they lead me in the beautiful paths and glorious refreshment of life everlasting. This is the original of the 23rd Psalm. I shall not in this divine presence want for food, nor thirst for water. Though I go down into the valley of uncertainty, or ascend up into the worlds of doubt, though I move in loneliness or with the fellows of my kind, though I triumph in the choirs of light,
or falter in the solitary places of the spheres. Your good spirit shall minister to me, and your glorious angel will comfort me. Though I descend into the depths of darkness and death itself, I shall not doubt you nor fear you, for I know that in the fullness of time and the glory of your name, you will raise me up to sit with you on the battlements on high. That is the story whispered in the night season to the shepherd boy. He could not retain it, word for word, but to the best of his memory, he gave it, much as it is recorded today. Sure, they worked on you.
The 12 groups of, what are they, master seraphim on the planetary government?
This is not this group.
No, but they're working for
them. Oh, sure they are.
You said that there were many beings that we would not recognize on Jerusalem.
On Jerusalem, right.
How many there are here that we don't recognize?
We'll recognize more. We'll recognize seraphim, Adams, Melchizedek's. Most of the time, I think. Lananandex. We won't recognize solitary messengers there.
Yeah.
We won't recognize them until we get all the way into Havana.
No, but we will know that they're there. That we'll know that the air is full.
Our thought adjusters will know they're there.
A lot of us are going to have to live in the homes of Adam and raise our kids.
Yes, generally.
It's up there that we'll it's up there that we'll study Mota. And Mota is not just a super philosophy. Mota has a different value. Mota is more than a superior philosophy. It is to philosophy as two eyes are to one. It has a stereoscopic effect on meanings and values. Material man sees the universe, as it were, with but one eye, flat. Mansion world students achieve cosmic perspective, depth, by superimposing the perceptions of the Marantia life upon the perceptions of the physical life. And they are enabled to bring these material and Marantia viewpoints into true focus, largely through the untiring ministry of their seraphic counselors, who so patiently teach the mansion world students and the Marantia progressors. We'll fraternize with the recorder teachers up there. These angels are all in the chain of recorders extending from the lowest to the highest custodians of the facts of time and the truths of eternity. Someday they will teach you to seek truth as well as fact, to expand your soul as well as your mind. Even now you should learn to water the garden of your heart as well as to seek for the dry sands of knowledge. Forms are valueless when lessons are learned. No chick may be had without the shell, and no shell is of any worth after the chick is hatched. But sometimes error is so great that its rectification by revelation would be fatal to those slowly emerging truths which are essential to its experiential overthrow. When children have their ideals, do not dislodge them. Let them grow. And while you're learning to think as men, you should also be learning to pray as children. Law is life itself and not the rules of its conduct. Evil is a transgression of law, not a violation of the rules of conduct pertaining to life, which is the law. Falsehood is not a matter of narration technique, but something premeditated as a perversion of truth. The creation of new pictures out of old facts, the restatement of parental life and the lives of offspring, these are the artistic triumphs of truth. The shadow of a hair's turning, premeditated for an untrue purpose, the slightest twisting or perversion of that which is principle, these constitute falseness. But the fetish of factualized truth, fossilized truth, the iron band of so-called unchanging truth holds one blindly in a closed circle of cold fact. One can be technically right as to fact and everlastingly wrong in the truth. And that's well illustrated
by one of the 28 philosophic illustrations of Maranchimota. The argumentative defense of any proposition is inversely proportional to the truth contained. A large core of all orders of the transition seraphim is held in the first mansion world, next to the destiny guardians. These transition ministers draw the nearest to humans of all orders of seraphim. I love this sentence here. Angels take delight in service, and when unassigned, often minister as volunteers. They're friendly. The soul of many an ascending mortal has for the first time been kindled by the divine fire of the will to service through personal friendship with the volunteer servers of the seraphic reserves. From them, you will learn to let pressure develop stability and certainty, to be faithful and earnest and withal cheerful, to accept challenges without complaint, and to face difficulties and uncertainties without fear. They will ask, if you fail, will you rise indomitably to try anew? If you succeed, will you maintain a well-balanced poise, a stabilized and spiritualized attitude throughout every long effort in the long struggle to break the fetters of material inertia to attain the freedom of spirit existence? Even as mortals, so have these angels been father to many disappointments, and they will point out that sometimes your most disappointing disappointments have become your greatest blessings. Sometimes the planting of a seed necessitates its death, the death of your fondest hopes, before it can be reborn to bear the fruits of new life and opportunity. And from them, you will learn to suffer less through sorrow and disappointment, first by making fewer personal plans concerning other personalities, and then by accepting your lot when you have faithfully performed your duty. You know, in the words of the Old Testament, these should be graven on the palms of our hands.
There's fewer personal plans concerning other personalities. Yes. That thing, I think,
isn't
gets more people get into the hole than anything else.
This sounds so good, we ought to jump right off a cliff.
Yes. Well, you know, to me it's intriguing. It's in connection with this early group of ministers that they tell so much that is so helpful in this life.
Mm-hmm.
You will learn that you increase your burdens and decrease the likelihood of success by taking yourself too seriously. Nothing can take precedence over the work of your status sphere, this world or the next. Very important is the work of preparation for the next higher sphere, but nothing equals the importance of the work of the world in which you are actually living. But though the work is important, the self is not. When you feel important, you lose energy to the wear and tear of ego dignity, so that there is little energy left to do the work. Self-importance, not work importance, exhausts immature creatures. It is the self element that exhausts, not the effort to achieve. You can do important work if you do not become self-important. You can do several things as easily as one if you leave yourself out. Variety is restful. Monotony is what wears and exhausts. Day after day is alike, just life, or the alternative of death.
Hallelujah.
Isn't that tremendous?
Marvelous.
Then it would be good for us to first learn how to live here before we try to master everything in the next universes.
Can you imagine a tadpole who is sulking over in one corner of the water, concentrating on living as a frog? This would be the most useless tadpole on the face of the earth. I am a man, and I'm very interested in doing the best job I can living as a man, not a Maranchi.
That rather discredits the Hindus that sit
yes.
all by themselves.
Yes, of course it does. It discredits the whole monastic concept. The whole monastic concept. Buddha's teaching may lead to monasticism in the concept of the arhat, but Buddha's life contains much more truth and presents as the other ideal in Buddhism, the bodhisattva, the one who serves, not the one who meditates. And then on the next page, you can go to school if you want to. They've given us half of their of the text of a lesson. They teach Maranshamota up there by the parallel technique. They put down citations of human philosophy and then the Mota equivalents. And they've given us half of the blackboard chalk talk of some teacher up there in these 28 philosophic illustrations of Maranshamota.
Bill, yes. I'm sorry, I'm not sure what Mota means.
Mota is their philosophy. It becomes possible. It becomes possible, Betty, because we have two levels of perception now. We still can perceive as we now perceive. We never lose this. You don't have to explain a sunset to a finaliter. He gets just as much out of that sunset as he did when he was a mortal among men. A divine counselor doesn't perceive a sunset. He never was human. So as Maranshans, we now have two levels of perception. We retain everything we have here, and we add to it Marancha perception. And now we're looking at reality from two levels, like two eyes instead of one eye. Mota has a stereoscopic depth perception into meanings, which no human being can have because we're one-eyed perceivers, just physical perception.
Where is that part in the book, Bill, where this divine counselor says, I don't know if it's a divine counselor, but he says, I cannot perceive the building I am in. Even the fellow next to me says,
I'll read it
to
you.
But the mighty messenger over there.
It's in the Celestial Art, isn't it?
Well, that's right. I think that's pretty good.
We'll read it right here because it touches on this point. You understand, of course, that what we're doing here is exploring the implications of one paragraph in paper 106, Incomplete Finites. All this is we're talking about is just that one paragraph in paper 106. Let's read what they say about perception. This paper is written by This paper is written by an archangel.
What page?
498. All these activities of the Maranshan spirit world are real. To spirit beings, the spirit world is a reality. To us, the material world is the more unreal. The higher forms of spirits pass freely through ordinary matter. High spirits are reactive to nothing material except certain of the basic energies. To material beings, the spirit world is more or less unreal. To spirit beings, the material world is almost entirely unreal, being merely a shadow of the substance of spirit realities.